We're going to open the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is Thursday, March 30th, 2005. We have Monica Brown, our Legislative Fiscal Officer, with us, and Kat Bell, our Subcommittee Assistant. For the record, I am Representative Greg Smith. Today we're going to do a public hearing on House Bill 5063, the Public Utility Commission. And I think tomorrow we're going to take this to a work group, but today we'll do the public hearing portion of it. Just so everyone knows the agenda, we're going to start off with an agency overview, go to performance measures, look at agency priorities and potential reductions. If there is any public testimony, we'll take it. And then we'll hear from Satish about the governor's recommended budget. And then for the Public Utility Commission. So that's the agenda for today. We do have two full days, committee members, so feel free to give these commissioners all the questions you would like to.
Good.
I think they're very well prepared to come before us today. Welcome.
Thank you.
You lead off.
I lead off? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you led off.
Mr. Beyer, why don't you start off with introducing yourself?
So much for the very well prepared part.
So much for being prepared. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm the chairperson of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I have with me Rick Willis, who is our executive director, and when I stumble, his job is to catch. So we'll see if that works. We've prepared a PowerPoint presentation to sort of, I hope, move us through quickly, and I hope that we've prepared it in the format you've grown accustomed to, and so we'll try to go through that. And if I don't screw this up technologically, we'll go through it very quickly. Oops. And I started off screwing it up. We were going to, as the chair just said, our walkthrough, we're going to give you a very quick background on the PUC, our agency's goals, overview of the programs, our performance measures and outcomes, the 10% reductions that you ask about, priorities, and then some budget details in our option packages. Start off with, I think the basic question for those who haven't done this before is, why is there a PUC and why are we here? Essentially, we are the regulators of what historically, and our agency goes back over 100 years, is monopoly industry. Now, there's been some changes in that, but basically our role is to protect the residents and industries that are served by those monopoly utilities and get them fair and equitable prices. And in later years, going back into the 90s, the legislatures had directed us to try to promote competition. In the 80s, in the promoting into the telecom industry, and most recently with Senate Bill 1149, trying to promote some competition in electronic or into the energy industries. Oops. And as I said, our mission is to ensure that safe and reliable utility services are provided to customers at just and reasonable rates and help develop competitive markets. We serve the electric industry. 75% of the state's customers buy their electricity from one of three regulated utilities, Portland General, PacifiCorp, and Idaho Power. We also regulate three natural gas companies, and those include Northwest Natural, which is our largest and is based in Portland, but also Avista and Cascade, which serve east of the mountains and southern Oregon. We regulate telecommunications, the four largest communications company. The largest is Quest, followed by Verizon, CenturyTel, and Sprint. And we also regulate 29 smaller individual companies, some of which are co-ops. And then in the competitive sense, we certify competitive providers. We call them CLECs. Actually, Congress calls them CLECs. There are roughly 400 competitive providers out there competing with the incumbent providers. And finally, we regulate 82...
Really quick, the acronym CLEC. Can you tell us what that stands for?
Competitive...
Local Exchange
Provider. Local Exchange is the... We also call it Wire Center. It's the terminus area where all the calls are switched through. As I was saying, we also regulate 82 small water companies that are actually scattered over every piece of the state, and they're generally outside of municipal areas, and they were usually formed around a development deal to allow subdivision of land, and the remnants are our regulated utilities. Beyond that, we do some other things, too. We provide for gas pipeline safety under contract with the federal government, ensuring that the pipelines that run through the state are safe. I like to say that that's something that nobody knows about and doesn't want to know about. If you do know about it, we've screwed up. We also operate the Oregon Universal Service Fund, which is a legislative mandate from the legislature to equalize payments of telephone bills across the state so that both high-cost areas and urbanized areas pay roughly the same bill. Then we operate a couple of programs under what we call our Residential Service RSP, a Protective Fund. I always get that acronym wrong. What it is it's programs that serve the hard of hearing or the deaf and also low-income protections on that and those that have extreme medical needs. And finally, we provide consumer protection for utility customers and working with them. Just at the start, the PUC is a other funds agency, and basically that means that our funds are paid for by the customers themselves, and they're not part of the general taxation of the state of Oregon. Our statutory authority, our general powers, come out of ORS Chapter 756, and the other applicable statutes are listed on the screen there. The two principal ones are Chapter 757, which deals with energy companies, and 759 that deal with telecommunications. Organizationally, we're split up into three organizational units. Our utility programs is where most of our professional technical staff is. That's our engineers, our economists, our CPAs that overview the finances of the company and the service quality and deal with that. Policy and administration is the support for the commission, the standard business functions that you see in any organization, and also that houses the RSPF program, manages that service, and that's where our consumer protection services are. And the third area then is our administrative hearings area, which are the support there. We have six administrative law judges that serve the commission and run the procedures for us, help us write our orders. Our major budget issues, the two mega ones that are out there are in our telecommunications assistance program, our OTAP program, which serves the low income. We've seen an increase in the last 2 years of 20,000 recipients dealing with that. I suspect that that has a lot to do with the changes in the economy and the downturn we've recently seen. The second area is an increase in emergency medical certificates, and essentially what that is the people who find themselves, because of medical conditions, unable to pay their bills. Our role in that is to help them work out with the utility payment plans so that they do not have a disconnect. Obviously, if you have someone that's having extreme medical problems, what you don't want is a situation where they can't call 911. Revenue-wise, the charts that we have up here are split. We have, as I was saying earlier, three sources of revenue. Our utility, and they're split into limited funds in the budget category and non-limited funds. The non-limited funds are essentially the Oregon Universal Service Fund, which is a charge on the bill that, again, comes in, and it's a direct pass-through under formula basis back to the telephone companies to help them equalize the rates so everybody can get the same fee.
Really quick, before we jump into this, Senator Morse has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To go back to the emergency medical certificates, Commissioner, you passed a bill off the floor of the Senate today that extended the ability for people that are vulnerable to make sure that they are not cut off in their phone service, that they still have access. How does that bill relate to your current provisions here for emergency medical certificates?
Senator, is that Senator Walker's bill?
Oh, gosh.
Is that the one?
I believe so.
That would expand the universe of people who could get assistance from this, and essentially those that are, what's the terminology?
Our caucus, too.
The additional group that's coming. Domestic violence, thank you. Extends it to that. So it just expands the pool of people.
Okay.
Who are potentially
but it's an extension of your current program.
Extension of the current program. Okay. It adds to the medical those who are subject to domestic violence.
Thank you.
Okay. Really quick, the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program. You folks are, do you not only collect that cash, you also, are you the, who's the granting agency? How does that money get back out to the communities?
The OUSF?
The Oregon Telephone Assistance Program. How's that administered?
Chair Smith, we administer it. The telephone companies, people are certified for it.
Okay.
The telephone companies give them the discount. We then give them money.
Okay, so the telephone company makes the decision on who's eligible for...
No, actually, the decision, there's within statute, there are provisions for who qualifies. As soon as we know that they're qualified, we tell the telephone company. They then give the discount and send us a bill and says we give the discount to X amount of people. Most of that money comes from the federal government, and $3.50 of it comes out of state.
Okay. Let's just really quick, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. Rick Willis, Executive Director of the Public Utility Commission.
Share with me really quick. I'm in need. How do I go about accessing the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program?
You would go to the Department of Human Services and apply for one of their low-income programs.
Okay. So someone within the Department of Human Services would qualify me and walk me through the process.
Exactly. We don't have our own process because we just use theirs and no sense in having two duplicate processes. So they notify us, it's all done electronically through databases, of who is eligible.
Thank you.
And then they can...
We just need a little 101 there on how that works.
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
So going back then, Mr. Chair, that's Universal Service Fund. The other two are the RSP... F fund, which is essentially about $10 a month on each telephone bill, that provides the funding for the disabled, hearing impaired actions in the low income piece. And then the other piece is the fees that are charged that support the regulatory services, our mainline business, if you will. Another way of looking at that is just if you looked at the whole pie together, this is how it breaks out. Obviously, the biggest piece of it is the Universal Service Fund and the others, and the biggest chunk of our separate money is RSPF. On the expenditure side...
Let's go back to the revenue really quick. Share with us, how is cell phones and their increase, how has that affected the RSPF fund?
Mr. Chair, dramatically.
Really quick, I'm going to, because I think for several of us this is a new experience dealing with, even though I've worked with the Public Utility Commission for three sessions, I still feel like this is a new budget to me. Can we avoid the acronyms?
We'll try. Sorry.
As we go through here, it'll make our job a little easier.
The explosive growth in cell phones, many of us have at least one, many two, has increased the fee because each one of those lines contributes to 10 cents per customer per month. And as a matter of fact, it has caused us to have too much money in that fund. What it actually costs to operate that fund is between 12 and 13 cents per person per month. We are currently at 10 cents. To bring it down because cell phones have just gone through the ceiling.
So now you regulate the fee that's charged, not the legislature.
Right. Mr. Chair, the legislature has set a cap of 35 cents as a maximum that the PUC can charge. The commission reviews that fee each year and sets it accordingly. And like I said, with the explosion of cell phones, we saw we were collecting too much and so backed it off lower than what it actually costs to spend down that ending balance.
Thank you.
where was I? Anyway, back where I was, anyway, that's the way the expenditures go out. As you can see, the majority of it go out through pass-through funds. In terms of our limited fund, our budget itself, we're structured budgetarily into three program areas: policy administration, utility, and then the reserve fund. Shifting to our goals, we have six general goals, and they are to establish effective price and service protections for customers, to enforce safety and reliability and service quality standards, to inform the Oregonians about the changes in the markets and the services to them, promote technology and fair and effective competition, attempt to influence the regional and federal energy and telecommunications policies, and to assist customers in resolving consumer complaints.
Are you going to share with the committee how you folks attempt to influence the federal policy? Do we have someone back in Washington, D.C. representing us?
We do not on these issues. How we do that, Mr. Chair, is that we are essentially involved through our National Association of Regulatory Agencies called NARUC, and we are involved in that in working with both the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the two dominant commissions, and with Congress. In Congress, we work directly with the Oregon's congressional delegation to try to inform them about how the legislation that's in front of Congress will affect consumers in Oregon.
Do we have any congressional delegates in key committees that would...
We do have.
Could you share those with us?
Congressman Walden is a very key member of the committee in the House that's dealing with telecommunications rewrite, which will have a major impact on the nation and Oregon. Senators Smith and Wyden have been on the committees that have oversight on energy in the Senate. Senator Wyden just shifted off of that on the budget committee. So we have had some fairly key involvement and have a very good working relationship with their offices. Their staff call us fairly frequently to say, what does this mean? How will this affect? And we provide them with information as well.
Thank you.
Commissioner Baum serves on a Federal Communications Committee, National Committee, that actually is involved in two of them now that are working on the rewrite of the Telecommunications Act and also on changing the fee structure that supports telephones, particularly critical to the small telephone companies that are serving rural Oregon. It's called access fees, and it's the connection fee that companies pay each other for initiating or changing long-distance calls. Will have a very big effect long-term in how that'll work out. It's a key issue in terms of the technology changes. You probably heard about the acronym VoIP, Voice Over the Internet Protocol, cellular phones. All of that basically is changing the way telecommunications services are funded. And if it's not done right, could make it very expensive or very hard for people who live outside of metropolitan areas to get telecommunications services. So it's a big issue to the state and very complicated.
Thank you.
Okay, so moving into our programs then, as I said, we're broken into three areas, and I'm going to walk through them. The first area is what we call utilities, and utilities includes electric and natural gas, telecommunications, what we call our economic research and financial analysis section, and regulatory operations. It also talk about the Residential Service Protection Fund. See, I did it without the acronym. And that includes the telephone relay services, which essentially is if you're deaf and you make a call or someone makes a call to you, there's someone in the middle there who types the information out and communicates both ways so that someone who's deaf can get a telephone call.
Do you see at some point that being automated to where it's computer?
We actually have done we're one of two states that have joined into something called CapTel, which is a step towards automation of that. I think the ultimate on that, if it was going to work, would be voice recognition, but it's just not there yet.
Okay.
It's very close, though, with the system that we put in place to, if you're deaf, you're very close to being able to communicate in the same fashion as someone with regular voice.
Perfect.
In terms of it comes through. The other piece of that one, besides the relay services, is the telecommunications device access program, which essentially it's just hearing amplification systems that we loan out to people, buy and loan out. And then the assistance program, which is a low-income program. Policy and administration section includes the commission and the agency support units. Okay, starting off with electricity and natural gas then, essentially that deals with the regulation services, oversight of those agencies, and also our safety program for pipeline and electrical safety. We have, in addition to the three electrical companies that we rate regulate, we also do safety regulation for all utilities in the state, public and consumer-owned. The responsibilities, as I said, is the ensuring that there's safe and reliable energy at reasonable rates, and we promote competition. How do we do that? Again, we set rates, promote the price and service. Excuse me. And we work to make sure that the systems are in place and in a safe way. The rate setting process is done through what we consider our standard rate cases, and essentially that's a periodic review. Usually it's the utilities are coming into us and asking to have a higher rate, and we have the process of going through auditing their services, and it's a legal process to go through and deal, legalistic, judicial-type process where people come in and they're interveners in the cases, and we discuss that and end up issuing a final order to get
them. Do Oregon utilities have a guaranteed rate of return? How does that work if I'm Northwest Natural Gas?
We don't have the jargon is you don't have a guaranteed rate of return. You have an authorized rate of return, which means once we, and how we get to that is we look at the cost projections that a utility comes in, they ask for a rate. Okay. And we'll say, how did you get to that rate? We look at the expenses and the revenue requirements, argue about those, and determine what we think are reasonable estimates of what those costs will be. Included in that is a computation of what the an acceptable rate of return would be. And once you have that, based on, that's called a test case, we set a rate. Within that rate, then, is the opportunity, if they manage the company within the assumptions that we had, you know, if the costs come in as they started, if they sell as much gas or electricity as they projected, have a good water year in the case of electricity, all that goes right, they'll earn their authorized rate of return. If they're more efficient, they can earn more than that. If things go south, they can earn less than that. So it's a standard kind of process. We like to think that those rates will be in place for 2 to 5 years, but we have the authority to call them in for rate cases, but it shifts the burden of who has to prove the case. If we call them in, the burden shifts to us. If they come in, the burden is on their side of the ledger. So as a rule of thumb, they come in. So if you're a utility, you're less likely to come in if everything's in line and you're making a little bit more money, and you're more likely to come in if you were guessed wrong and your costs are higher.
Got it.
But the law that we deal with under that, that the legislature has set up, and in fact it's also established by the federal constitution, is that they are indeed private companies and they are entitled to a fair rate of return. So we have to balance that sort of, we come at it from the ratepayer's perspective. I like to say that my job is to get you the lowest cost possible while allowing a fair return for them. And that's
perfect.
The core of the cases.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of balancing residential and industrial users,
mm-hmm.
and setting those rates, for example, in natural gas, how do you determine the balance? What kind of benchmark in other states?
Natural gas is a little easier, Senator, because you're pretty much selling the commodity. When we're selling for natural gas, the gas companies are not allowed to make a profit on the commodity, the gas itself. What they're allowed to make a return on is their investment in the plant, the distribution plant. So the cost, you know, we have transportation costs, they're fairly standardized, and there isn't as much a difference. If you're asking me about an electrical utility, there's a difference in serving electricity to, say, a house where you have peak periods of electrical usage, and it's a little more expensive to get the service delivery there than, say, an electronics semiconductor plant where you've got an operation that's running 24/7 and the load varies very little at all, so you can actually buy a better power stream for that. So what the law says is that we have to take that into consideration so that all users are paying their fair and equitable share of the cost, that one's not paying the other share. Did I answer it?
This discussion could go on, Mr. Chair, much beyond the context of this forum. So yeah, we can pick that up at a later date. Thank you.
Okay. And it does, you know, you asked the question around natural gas. There is a little difference on natural gas. Some of the very large gas users, if they're close to a pipeline, have the right under federal law to buy the gas directly from the pipeline and don't even go through, like, Northwest Natural. Or they can buy what's called transportation services, or they buy the gas and they pay a fee to Northwest Natural for transporting the gas from source to their location.
That was really the point of my question, but
yeah,
that's for another day. Thank you.
Okay.
Why don't we continue?
We'll keep moving on. I think that covered most of these points. I'm going to kind of rush through them rather than take a lot, because it the performance measures that we've set out, and there are a number here. First one for is that the average price of electricity for residential users in Oregon will be about the same as the national average. And these are targeted. Our target for 2003 was that we'd be at 75% of the national benchmark. Our actual outcome was a little higher than that. We're about 84%. Some of these are, I mean, to be very frank, are kind of optimistic because we really don't have a lot of control over it. But second one was that personal injuries related to the electric operations, and our target was to not have more than 0.5 injuries per 100,000 customers. We had a little higher than that, 0.94, but still very much below national averages. In the natural gas size, I mean, this is one to have zero accidents per 100,000. We like to say that no one was killed, and we have consistently met that for over a decade, and that's, I think, that's something very positive that the system's working there.
I'd like to go back to number one. You're pretty good about getting back there quick. You're talking about the average price of electricity. Do we have pockets within the state where the price of electricity is extraordinarily high compared to the national average? And I'm not meaning to put
you on. I think, Ms. Chair, I think what you're probably asking me is PG's rates extraordinarily high, or are there other areas such as, well, actually, where the co-op that you, where you live, I think, Eastern Oregon has very high rates.
He was on one of my boards. Very well managed and low priced.
Okay.
Excellent customer service.
Compared to the national averages, our rates are not that. You know, our average rates are in the 8 cent a kilowatt range. Kilowatt hour range.
What I'm trying to get at is we have average. With an average, you're going to have a low. You're going to have a high. Oregon, do we have any pockets of high that?
Compare
that average.
Let me see if I can answer that. Compared to a national average, there are some areas in the country that have lower rates than us. Not many. There are most areas that have rates that are higher than all of ours. Within Oregon, there are some areas that have lower rates than, say, Portland General. There's a couple of co-ops that have a little higher rates too. The driver on that about three-quarters of the cost of delivering a kilowatt-hour of electricity is dependent on what you pay to generate or buy that. The overhead is a relatively small number compared to that. The public utilities, which tend to be the cheapest in the state, theirs costs are lower, and the reason they are lower is that, well, there's a couple of factors, but the major reason they're lower is they get what's called preference power from the Bonneville Power Administration. It's predominantly hydropower, and just a rule of thumb, if you're looking at Bonneville's rates, hydropower rates are about 3.1 cents a kilowatt hour wholesale for their delivered power. If you're going to get the same unit of electricity out of a natural gas-fired plant, you're looking at probably 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour.
Let me rephrase my question. This committee is economic development and transportation, mm-hmm. and I want to focus on economic development really quick. If a company is looking at coming into the state of Oregon and they turn a motor, one of their primary considerations is going to be the price of power. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming, based upon the years you've been before this committee, that you know that's something you take into consideration is the effect that price of power will have on the economy. The question I'm trying to get at is if the city of Portland or the state of Oregon was to become the owner of a power company and they became eligible for preferential power or were no longer regulated, one of the two options, you know, what would the effect be? I mean, if the city of Portland took over and was no longer regulated and they rose the price up to or lowered the I'm trying to think through the effect this would have on economic
sure.
development.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the answer is it depends.
Sure.
If your question is if Portland General became a consumer-owned electrical company, is there the chance that its rates would go down? It appears to me that they would qualify as a preference customer for BPA, which would mean that they would have the opportunity to buy power cheaper. Now, the other factor that goes into that is BPA only has an average of 9,200 megawatts, and they're oversubscribed already.
So what's that mean to our co-ops?
So that would mean that BPA would have to, if they were going to serve them, they would have to go out into the market and buy more power, and it'd be like creating stew. You would take all those costs and meld them together, and all of the customers' rates would obviously go up a little bit.
One last question on this, then we need to move on. If the city of Portland was successful in acquiring Portland General Electric, would you have authority? Would you have authority to oversee them as they currently?
Mr. Chair, under existing law, the Public Utility Commission only regulates private utility companies, so we would not have. We do not have. Other than for safety, we have no regulatory authority over consumer-owned utilities.
So I just want to be clear, and then I want to move on here. So if the city of Portland chose to acquire Portland General Electric, ultimately it would be the city council then that would serve as the regulatory body over
Mr.
Portland
that
General
would be
Electric.
My assumption.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so we were natural gas. There. Getting back to the performance issues, Mr. Chair, we're another one of ours is in promoting competition, and our goal was the total number of electric service suppliers certified and aggregators registered with the PUC to sell power. Our target was to have 20 suppliers registered. In 2003, we had 12, so we didn't quite get there on that. It was, I like to say, as one of the carriers of Senate Bill 1149 in 1999, that it was a lot easier to pass the legislation than it has been to make it work. But we keep trying, and we have done better. Another of our goals was the percentage of customers with electric energy usage supplied by alternative providers or direct access. Again, the target was 1%, and we had none. and 2003. I would like to just tell you, though, that it hasn't been as bad as those numbers show. In 2005, we actually now have 24 companies that are direct customers, are buying power directly from other than the utility. It's actually 29. 24 with PGE and 5 with Pacific Core. PGE represents 10, almost 10.5% of the large industrial load is going direct, and in Pacific Core it's a little over 2%. And we have 8 energy service providers other than the utilities that are selling services.
One of the things I'm going to share with the committee, the co-chairs have asked us to work with you folks on working on these performance measures to make them more relevant to your agency. As we look at some of these personal injuries related to natural gas operations, you could be doing everything very, very well, and an accident's going to be outside of your ability to prevent that. Mm-hmm. And so what we're going to want to do when we get to this issue tomorrow is work through these and try and find out if or find more relevant performance measures. And perhaps for tomorrow, you folks could take a look at 1 through 9 and okay. help us find some that perhaps would help you and help us do a better job of measuring performance. And
Mr. Chair, to be honest with you, we've stumbled with this one, trying to figure out exactly how you get to that and some of the regulatory functions we have, because I think we do a pretty good job of regulating the cost, but a lot of things are out of our control, and in some cases they're out of the control of the utility itself.
Well, one of the things we've done with other agencies and departments is we've provided some framework and then have asked those folks to go work on it and then report back in the interim to the audits committee on performance measures that make more sense.
And Mr. Chair, we would be very happy to work with the committee and would be very welcoming of your recommendations on things that the legislature believes is important in terms of setting the goals.
And the converse, those that would help you do a better job of determining your success.
Okay. Again, some of the other things in terms of our accomplishments, we talked a little bit about the direct access already. We did, through our efforts, we're able to achieve $8 million in refunds for electrical customers, and we're working on some other cases with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to try and get customers a little more money back out of the 2001 energy crisis. One of the things that we have done in recognition is we think that utilities and the regulatory agencies dropped the ball in the pre-2001 crisis as we went away from what we call our integrated resource planning documents, and we've gone back to that and are working more tightly, frankly, with the energy companies to make sure that we have some plans out there and don't get caught unprepared again. And with regards to the energy trust, I know that's of interest to some people. We have worked on that and have adopted in the last year some fairly stringent targets for them, or benchmarks, if you will. Shifting now, Mr. Chair, to the telecommunications area again.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I can't let this go without...
I didn't think you would, Representative.
A question. Where are the new performance measures and targets for the trust?
I don't think we have them in this package, do we?
Nay. We have them.
We have them. I'm not
but
sure.
Commissioner, could you make them available to the professional staff and pass through to all of us? I think there may be others who would like to see how they're performing as much as I'm interested in it. This has been an issue. I've followed it for some time, and I'm particularly interested to see how they are containing their administrative costs.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I know you have a keen interest in this, and I'd be happy to do that. And I would tell you that if your schedule permits, I think it's tomorrow morning. Tomorrow at 8:30, the audits committee is going to spend some time specifically on that subject.
Oh, great.
I would share with the committee that... based upon the findings of the audit committee, hopefully very successful, they'll be reporting to us on what they uncover.
With respect to the trust?
Correct.
Good.
Correct.
But we will get you the benchmarks, and I think, trying to think, it's either last week or it might have been even this week, I did sign transmittal to all the legislators sort of updating the performance through the end of December.
Mr. Chair, would you allow a follow-up?
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Is it the Public Utility Commission that provides the oversight for the trust? You are the body that is actually looking and tracking these performance measures. Are there others that are watching how the trust performs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I think the world is watching what the trust does. But
well, perhaps I stated that a little
formally.
There was more elasticity in my question than I was really looking for.
Formally, we have the responsibility to track that on behalf of the ratepayers because it is ratepayers' money. And we're joined in that regard by the Department of Energy. And one of the ways we do that, besides a fairly tight contract, is... Commissioner Savage and a senior member of the Department of Energy sets on the trust board of directors as ex officio members. So we're fair to say we're actively involved in that.
One more
please.
Does your oversight extend down into scrutiny of individual projects and how they're performing? Because I know at times in the past, when I made inquiry about the performance of individual projects, I was told that that was all shielded by confidentiality and that the trust at that time was adhering to the spirit of the open meetings and the spirit of public disclosure laws rather than making their projects actually available for any level of review. And therein is the seed of some of my discontent with the performance of the trust. I understand that some of the alternative energy projects may cost more, but I was just curious with respect to the depth of detail that the PUC exercises their oversight authority of the performance of the trust, whether you're getting into the level of individual projects.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, that issue of the open records, open meetings, was something that we spent a lot of time in developing the benchmarks, and I think it's fair to say that while I think it was open before, we've been very clear that we don't want to hear that term confidentiality much at all, and I think you'd find it was different. Having said that, there obviously are in the business dealings, particularly the larger projects, some need to protect some proprietary information. That information may not be available, probably isn't available to the general public where it legitimately needs to be protected, but it is available to our staff and it is available to the board members of the trust and through that venue to Commissioner Savage and the senior members from the Department of Energy. That process on the larger projects, and I want to be careful in using the term the project because some people would use that to describe, you know, I'm doing a project weatherizing, you know, somebody's home.
Mm-hmm.
And now, frankly, we don't look at that. We're looking at the overall home weatherization program.
Yeah, a program versus some big one-off project.
If we're looking at the Three Mile Canyons project over in Central Oregon or Northeastern Oregon, that one, those projects are large. They get into potentially millions of dollars, and we spend a lot of time looking at those and making sure that the costs are legitimate. From the renewable side, what we're generally looking at, besides pure cost efficiency, is that we're not paying any more than the gap necessary to make the project economic and
one
efficient.
Of the things
The answer is we get at it, you know, on that side.
Senator, after our meeting today, I've asked Commissioner Beyer to sit down with me and to walk. It'll be part of our discussion, walking through how does the process work? How does a company go about making application, timelines, et cetera, because those are issues I've raised. But because of timing, it's probably a meeting outside of here. But I'd be more than open to having you sit in with us on that.
Well, I would appreciate that opportunity, Mr. Chair, and I guess one of the other things that I'm particularly concerned about, Senator Morris and I have been spending a lot of time on board performance and how engaged boards are around agencies. It seems to me that the trust's board has a particular call to respond to a high level of expectations with respect to the discharge of their fiduciary responsibilities, i.e. performing like a board. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm very concerned about is where their board members come from, how often that board is refreshed. If it is a self-perpetuating board with little or no opportunity for other perspectives or points of view to come to the table, I think that would be very worrisome when they're paying ratepayers or spending ratepayers' money, and they have a pretty healthy flow of public money through that organization. And so I've just had a lot of questions over time about how the board is performing, and I'm particularly interested in visiting their administrative costs and what level of bureaucracy they're building around the whole discharge of their responsibilities.
Good questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. Where was I? I think I was moving back.
You were trying to make it to telecommunications, I think.
Okay. In telecommunications, we're looking at, again, the same similar kinds of issues, rate setting. Although in telecom, the issues of quality of service become more important to customers, as well as universal access to the basic services and promoting competition, both in terms of providers and technology. The rate setting process, again, is very similar. I'm not going to go through all of this. Essentially, a rate case comes in. You're not going to see as many from telecom providers. And, in fact, Quest, through Senate Bill 622 out of the 99 session, is rate capped. So the assumption at that period of time, trade-off they got was they can't raise their rates because they felt they needed flexibility to lower the rates and not have to post tariffs to meet competition. The other utilities, Sprint, Avista, not Avista, Verizon, and Century still are dealing on rate regulation, but again, it's a little different situation with them. One of the things I like to say about telecom is what we do a lot now is what's called interconnection agreements. I kind of call it putting on the black and white striped shirt. We referee between the companies to make sure that it's important if you want to use a cellular phone that cellular phone can actually get through to the landline you're calling. It's gets complicated, and we have some engineers, and we work a lot with trying to craft the FCC rules to make sure that they respond to our needs. So again, we're talking about and quality of services. We monitor that for the companies on a quarterly basis, actually a monthly basis, and looking at the speed with which, you know, the calls get through. Are there any delays? You know, can you actually call the company and get an answer? Those kinds of things. Universal Service Fund, again, we talked about that. That's funding that comes in on the Oregon side. There's a federal piece and an Oregon piece. There are roughly $55 million in the Oregon fund, and there's roughly the same number coming in federally, and those are distributed back out to the telephone companies to meet their high-cost service areas so that, again, the rates can be the same. Competition. I covered some of this already. One of the other issues that comes up a lot, and we spent a lot in the last year dealing with what's called extended area services. Our acronym is EASs. That's where you'll hear it the most. There are approximately 1,700 specific EAS routes in the state. Ones that people are most familiar with are in the Portland area, which is what we call a region where you can literally call from throughout the three county areas and not have to dial one. That's essentially it. And it's the trade-off. What the statute says is that if you're it's a convenience measure for the customers so that they don't have to deal with tolling calls. But for the company, it's a revenue-neutral process. So we go through that process when we review the rates every couple of years for each area to make sure they're the same. Most recently, we responded to a citizen's request in Southern Oregon and established the second region of the state down there. There's some thoughts that we might need to there may be consumer interest in having a region in Central Oregon and also on the coast. So they take a lot of time, and it's a trade-off with that.
So how does that work? The base fee is increased to cover the cost of no longer doing the long distance call?
Essentially, what we do, and I'm going to oversimplify this, is we estimate the amount of traffic or phone calls that are going to be made, what the revenue of that would be, and we meld that together into a set fixed rate that every customer will pay. There is a deviation from that. If you don't want to, you can still go on what's called metered service. But it's just, it's a levelized payment, and it's really, I like to think of it as it's a convenience. Frankly, when we did the one in Southern Oregon, I thought, you know, why would anybody want to do this with cell phones and all this? But it's a big deal down there. I mean, they love it. You know, Dr. Bates was telling me the other day, stopped me in the hallway and says, you can't believe how important this was to us. And I'm kind of going, okay. But our approach to that is that that's what the customers want. That's what we'll help them get.
Is it a vote of the citizenry then to determine that? How do you decide?
Technically, a vote is not required. What we did in Southern Oregon is we did exactly that. We sent a ballot out in the bills to the where the high-cost areas would be and said, is this what you want?
Interesting. Thank you.
No, so it's a big deal to them. But I think if you lived in the Portland area, you've had it for a while, and you don't even notice that $2 on your bill.
In Eastern Oregon, you call across the street, and it's long distance.
There you go. We have a number of routes over there. We actually had one, a good example, in Helix. Just before I was on the council, the people wanted to be able to call into Pendleton, and we did that rate and found out that the rate would be, how much was it?
A lot.
It's like $100 a month, and they said, you know, maybe I'll pay a toll call.
Great. Thank you.
Performance measures we've set up on this. The first one is percent of total switched access lines provided by competitive providers. Our target was 12%, and our outcome in 2003 was 14%. So we made it there. Other accomplishments, and that's the only goal that we had in that area. The accomplishments is one of them is we got Sprint to invest a little over $4 million, almost $4.5 million in making a substantial amount of improvements in their service territory and got about $500,000 in rate reduction. We've also certified 475 companies to compete in the telecom market. Those are what we were talking about, the CLECs or competitive providers. And we've approved 20 new EAS routes, including the Southern Regional EAS in Southern Oregon. I'm going to switch now to the Residential Service Protection Fund. I said it without the acronym. There are four programs in that fund. They are the Oregon Telephone Relay Service, which we were talking about a minute ago, the Telecommunications Devices Access Program, and that's the one where we lend out equipment for the hearing impaired. The telephone assistance program is the program for low assistance, and the emergency medical assistance program is the one helping negotiate bill payments for people with medical problems. The relay service, 24 hours relay, we've approximately do 140,000 minutes each month on that, and we're that's funded by a 10-cent monthly surcharge on all subscriber bills. And again, as you suggested, we're looking for new technologies all the time. Just started one last year. The lending program, the devices, we're about 10% of Oregonians have a hearing and speech or a physical disability. And we've got about 3,800 recipients of the devices today, and the trends are that those are going to increase. And I think possibly a lot of that, as you might expect, is as the baby boomers get older, as everyone gets older, it gets a little harder to hear, and you have a higher need for those devices. Our performance measures that we had for this was dealing with participants who are 65 years or older. Was that 33? Our target was serving 33% of that. The outcome is we actually served 36% who were receiving the TDAP services.
This is a case in point on a performance measure that I'm not sure what that tells you or tells us.
I think what that is intended to show is the percentage of the eligible population that's getting services. We've talked a lot about how to get at that and how to measure that. It would be very interesting
to
me.
Facetious. I mean, how are you going to control 60-someone from aging?
Well, it's essentially, you know, I think you're right. I think what you're saying is how effective are we at outreaching. But even if we were absolutely superb at outreach, it doesn't mean that everybody would choose to use the service.
We'll work on those.
Yeah. It took me a long time to get my father to get an amplified phone, which we bought in the marketplace, didn't buy through the state. But talking about the telephone assistance program, we were talking about that. It provides a maximum of $1,350 per month for the recipient in terms of aiding them in their bill. We contribute through the PUC $3.50, and the feds contribute $10. One of the things we did notice is that we are underserving that population, and as a result of that, frankly, we're not getting our share of the federal money, even though ratepayers are paying into the federal fund.
How did you find that out?
How did we find that out? We got a report from the FCC that showed how much money each state was getting and how much they were putting in and percentage of services to it. So that was one of our benchmarks, was to try and increase that. And essentially, again, that the linkage there, what we've tried to do more of is work closer with the people who do food stamps and other public assistance and make sure that in their processes they make recipients of those programs aware that this service is there for them if they choose to use it and help them out. So it's just, frankly, another form of transfer payment. Mm-hmm. It's out there. Medical assistance. That program, I'm not going to go in great detail. Essentially, it's they have to prove that there's a medical problem, and essentially what we're doing there is working with their provider to make the bill affordable for them. The issue is they have to pay the bill. It's just arranging a payment plan that works. Our accomplishments. One of the ones that we're very proud of, and you heard me mention the CapTel program, but that's a new program that's state-of-the-art technology. Oregon was one of the two first states to advance to that. The program, the important part of that is it makes a better service to the recipients. It makes them closer to you and I in being able to use the telephone and being able to get the services and have a reasonable conversation with somebody. All right. Switching over to our second program area, policies and administration. This is the umbrella program that essentially covers the business activities of the Public Utility Commission, Consumer Protection Program, and
hearing side.
Commission office, three commissioners, support staff. The administrative hearings, we have six administrative law judges that assist us with managing those cases. They also, besides managing the cases for us, they directly manage arbitrations between customers and the utilities, as well as between utilities and utilities. Performance measures for the hearing section. Percentage of interconnection agreements processed in 45 days or less. It's a measure we set. Was a new measure in 2003. We had 30. Our goal was 30% of the agreements were to be processed in 45 days or less. Our new target is to try to get that up to 40%.
I'm gonna ask you to go back. I'm sorry. I still don't know interconnection agreements. Can you explain that one more time to me? What those are.
Interconnection agreement is if you buy your service from a phone company other than the fully regulated phone company, like Quest.
Okay.
In order to provide you that service, they have to interconnect with another company, and there's service quality to do. There's conditions to do that, measurements and agreements that they have to run into, as well as compensation schedules.
Perfect. Thank you.
I think that Congress has taken care of some of that because some of their changes may eliminate competitive providers, but we'll see. Just some of the I'm having a little trouble reading this. It's been focused with it. The increased evidentiary hearings, procedural conferences that we've listed up there is just the sense of how it's going. I think the bottom line that I'm trying to get through here is that we're seeing more. It's expected. More of it comes in. And one of the things I think that people don't think about when you're promoting competition is that when you have more competition, you have more opportunities for disagreements and more opportunities to involve that. So it impacts us in a different way. In some ways, it was far easier to regulate four telephone companies than it is to regulate 300 telephone companies trying to do business with each other.
Senator Johnson.
Commissioner Beyer, is there a threshold to get before the commission, or is there any kind of process that deflects potential folks that are disagreeing out of evidentiary hearings prior to the time that they get there? To what degree do you rely on dispute resolution or any other mechanisms to... I'm just trying to get a sense of how fine the sieve is before people get in front of the PUC.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it depends. I've sort of been focusing on the telephone, but there are also regular citizens' matters where they're challenging a bill or something like that. Most of that we try to work out informally through our consumer services side on that. In fact, our preference is that we work that out. We encourage people to work it out with the utility, and we try to intercede and do that. But they have a right, if they can't resolve that, to ask for arbitration.
How far does that right go? I mean, is it as simple as me submitting a letter to the PUC saying I have a disagreement with my utility company, I would like arbitration?
Submitting a letter, filing a complaint. We have a process. They can do it. Send it in writing to us or file an electronic filing. They have a right to, it's a judicial process, they have a right to do that. And
how difficult is the filing process?
Chair Smith, no. We tried to make it as simple as possible, and I understand they make it more difficult with the FLIC folks. But on the other hand, we wanted to make sure that citizens had the right to the due process. We do try to go through, as Senator Johnson talked about, dispute resolution. We work with the companies first. And frankly, the majority of the problems and complaints are resolved that way. It's fairly rare when those citizen complaints make it all the way to a formal hearing.
Well, that's going to have me ask another question. Who tells the citizen that they have this option?
I'm sorry.
Who informs a citizen that they have this option to file a complaint? I have a complaint. I don't like my phone bill.
Look on your phone bill.
It's on the bill.
It's right on the phone bill.
You have a right to address the public.
It is on the phone bill.
And we have it on our website. We put it on pamphlets that we send out. It's in a number of places.
I mean, to be very, I think I know where your question is going. Frankly, we believe that we probably get maybe 1 out of 10 complaints that are out there. So, I mean, most people, unless they're really frustrated and persistent, don't get to us. So, I mean, that means the ones you get sometimes are harder. But keep in mind, Mr. Chair, that we work for the ratepayers. We don't want to put obstacles in front of them. They're paying us to represent them. So that our orientation is to work for the ratepayers, but at the same time, be fair and try to resolve the issue as quickly and as easy as we can. If it's a billing dispute, what we're trying to do is get the billing dispute taken care of. And I'm very proud of the fact that we're pretty successful at working that out. Frankly, telephone issue is a good one. When a consumer calls us, you know, they may not be able to get an answer. They may not feel that they do get the appropriate answer from the company, but when one of our staff calls the company, we usually get the problem addressed.
Okay.
And I think that's why we're there.
And Mr. Chair, let me add, the first part of the process is to ask the customer, have you attempted to work it out with the company? And if the answer is no, that's where we have them begin. And oftentimes, that takes care of it. When they talk to the company, they're able to work out something and PUC is not involved. It's only after they are unable to resolve it directly with the company that the PUC starts getting involved.
Well, I'm assuming that the last thing the company wants is a phone call to you folks. Yeah.
Well, in my term of chair, and Mr. Willis has heard this, the thing that I'm most concerned about is protecting the customers. I'm pretty sure the companies can take care of themselves. And we're fair.
Thank you. Let's proceed forward.
So anyway, so the volume's going up. Where are we going? The next slide just speaks to the more efficient ways of dealing with that. We moved to trying to do more over the telephone where we could and less dragging people in, trying to be more responsive to people's needs. I'm going to shift real quickly to the water program. This is our smallest effort. Frankly, it's kind of a pain to us, but it's real important to the people who get the service, the water companies. So we have 28 of them, and we spend a lot of time with them. One of the things that's unique about water companies is they're very small, and you're talking about very small dollar volume. When you move from a Portland General Electric, where you're dealing with rate cases of $1.5 to $1.7 billion a year, and you move to Shadow Hills Water Company and you're dealing with $25,000, it's just as important to that company, and it's just as
right.
important to those customers. They present unique problems, and often part of it is our staff sitting down with them and helping them figure out how it is to structure their capital budget so indeed they are replacing the pipes and what have you to meet quality water standards and figuring out where
these are not municipalities, these are water companies.
These are not municipalities, these are water companies. These are small companies. They're the largest one is just shy of 3,000, and we actually have some that have, I think our smallest is like 18 or 25 customers.
It's in the teens.
Without breaching confidentiality, tomorrow could you bring just an example of how one of these companies operate? Is that possible?
I can give you a real good example of one that was in my backyard that I had to go down and deal with Lane County, a company called CB Loop Water. Small number, such a small area. When I first came on the commission, there was a case pending. And the owner, this is in Lane County, is where the company is. The owner lived in Bend. And commission staff had continuous problems with him and responsiveness, and they finally got to him and said, you have to be available to your customers. You're providing a critical service. You got to get an answering machine or an answering service or something so they can get hold of you. He says, okay, I'll get an answering machine. We got a complaint that the water was out, and there were 20-some people out of water and dealt with it, and they finally fixed it themselves and called us on a money, because unfortunately we're not open on weekends either. Our staff called him and said, we thought we had this resolved. He says, well, didn't you get an answering machine? Yes, I did. Well, what happened? He says, you didn't tell me I had to plug it in. So, I mean, there's a different operating style. So, took me back, Mr. Chairman, to some of the days when I used to work with small businesses, and most of them are very good. In fact, I would say almost all of them are very good. They're well-intentioned. Sometimes they don't quite have the skills necessary to run it, and we try to help them because, in the end, what's important is that the customer get water at a reasonable price that's, tastes good and is safe.
I come from an area where you have municipalities, irrigation districts, or you drill your own well. So I didn't know there were water companies.
Fortunately, the legislature hasn't saw fit to give us irrigation districts.
Senator Johnson.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out. That answer is just stunning to me. And I'm trying to figure out at what point is there a state interest in having an irresponsible operator providing an essential service not be in the water business anymore? And whether you have incentives to force consolidation or you have the ability to shut the operator down, I just, that answer is just stunning.
Well, Senator, in the last session you did give us some authority to go in and make repairs, and
recover it back from the owner to take care of some of those problems. And we have, I mean, frankly, when I first came on the commission was in the process, and frankly, in Bend, there was a rather large private water company that was serving inside the city of Bend that was, this particular company wouldn't spend a few thousand dollars to install some equipment to get the pressure up so that a person could take a shower in one house and his neighbor could water the lawn at the same time. I mean, some issues like that. But he could spend $5,000 a month in legal fees to tell us that we didn't have the right to tell him that. What we did, working with the Attorney General, was talk to the city of Bend and say, you ought to take over the water company, and they did a quick take on it, condemned it. He got paid out, but put it back in public hands because, I mean, these were citizens of Bend, and they had a city council that should have been providing them services and ended up doing that. We don't have the authority to do much else beyond that. In a critical situation, we have some, but these are private companies.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair. It would seem to me that a logical solution in this case would be to grant to you the authority to retain a contractor, you know, with appropriate notice of a violation or deficiency, to go in and actually make the correction and then turn around and extract it from the person that is providing the service, to actually have the authority to go in and make the correction.
Senator Morse, you actually did give us that authority in the last session.
We do have that now.
Actually, Rick reminded me that we did in a very... It was before my time, but there actually was a history of one case where they condemned the water company and sold it, I guess.
Yeah, first we hired in a contractor to operate the system while we were in the process of dealing with the owners and getting them out of it and then selling it off to some new folks. But it had gotten so bad that they simply refused to serve their customers, and we had to step in.
Is that the one in Klamath Falls?
No, it was in Central Oregon. Again, they seem to have particular problems in Central Oregon, Senator Whistler.
Water.
We have had this discussion.
No, this wasn't over quantity. This was over enough.
Okay, please continue.
Moving on, Mr. Chair. Where was I? Our performance measures for water utilities... number of water utilities adopting price changes. This is a new measure to encourage the sustainability, much as we've been talking about, through the public purpose programs and unity pricing. 2003, we didn't have a goal established, and our outcome is we have two water utilities that have adopted pricing changes. And again, that sounds odd, but the intent is to try and get them on a pricing schedule that allows them to operate on a business basis. That makes some sense, make the improvements. The next unit we'll talk about is what we call our economic research and financial analysis section. That actually does manage the water program, but the other thing that they do is they are our technical nerds, if you will, that provide analysis services across all utilities when we're doing rate cases. They're some of the economists and folks, CPAs, that do that kind of work. Whether it's a telecom case, a water case, or a energy case. Some of their accomplishments in the last biennium is we conducted 30 audits and identified accounting corrections to the benefit of customers. We reviewed applications, major applications, the Portland General, that you're all very aware of, and we've revised our rules to implement the 2003 laws that were passed. We talked about that in the water area and primarily in the water area. Another area that we do in this one is we talked earlier about the impact of BPA on Oregon's electrical rates, and we spend a lot of time working with them to make sure that our customers are represented and get a fair share of that. We're kind of proud of the fact that we were able to save customers a lot in the last year in negotiating a deal to get make sure that the private utility customers get a share of that revenue. We sort of have an ongoing fight between consumer-owned utilities, which have preference power, and the customers of the private utilities, which get a payment representing their share in that, and we argue a lot over how much that share should be. Obviously, the consumer-owned don't think that the private, they're usually the private company shouldn't get anything, but the point I would make with you is they don't. The money that we negotiate on behalf of the customers is a direct flow through the utility and reduces the rates that they charge to the residential customers under the Federal Power Act. So we think that's important.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bruce.
A question, Commissioner, on with respect to Portland's potential ownership of PGE, does that give them preference power rates, and what would be the impact to the other
provider?
We went
there earlier. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the answer has to be it depends. I believe if PGE were assumed as a public utility, public consumer-owned utility, that would put them in the position where they could, under the Federal Power Act, ask for preference power. They couldn't get the cheapest power right now because it's under contract, but probably starting in 2007 they could make a call on that power. The effect of that, as I said, earlier, would be VPA would have to provide it, and they would have to obtain the power someplace, and it would have a levelizing effect on everybody else, I believe. I believe that's what the effect would be. So I think they would have exactly the same standing that any other public utility would have in the same right.
You know, one point I think is important to bring up on this issue is, short of new legislation from this body, the city of Portland has the ability to make that purchase without any form of legislative authority. Mm-hmm. I believe that's correct.
I believe that's true.
Thank you. Why don't we proceed forward?
Okay. Consumer services, we talked a little bit about that, and again, we kind of went through what that is. Performance measures, our intent was to resolve investigations within 50 days or less. I'm not tracking with what I'm saying there, I'm sorry. Anyway, Rick, what am I trying to say here? I'm getting lost on this.
The target is to try to get 65% of the complaints resolved within 50 days or less.
How do you do that if you have a all it takes is one complicated complaint, and your average, no matter how great all the others are, is thrown off? Should we be using median? I mean, the word average, again, that's outside of your control.
Mr. Chair, medium may be better. And you're right that some of the complaints are multiple complaints and very complex complaints. On the other end of the spectrum, some are resolved fairly quickly. So they balance out, and that's how we come out with this.
I think this is an important performance measure, but I think it's one maybe we could break into two then to help with the two types of cases.
Maybe define it a little better. Okay, we'll work on that.
And again, I don't think we're the experts on helping you on writing the performance measures, but I think we need to have you folks think through those and tighten them up a little bit and make them more relevant.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to show you, this is a chart that covers since 2002 and gives you a sense of the number of complaints as they're coming in. And again, what strikes me about our processes is that I hadn't thought about when I was on your side of the dais is the effect of inducing competition. You know, it changes the parameters a little bit, and you end up with more complaints as people deal with that. It's been particularly true in the telephone area.
how we've done that is we've worked hard. We've done more extensive training with our staff to prepare them for that. One of the things that we did in the last year, frankly, that I'm pretty proud of, is we've signed a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Justice, Consumer Protection Section. They have an agreement with 27 other state attorney generals to implement consumer protection standards, some that are consent degree with cellular, most of the large cellular companies. We don't have direct authority over cellular companies, but working with them, we're now able to respond under their authority to help customers resolve those complaints. And I'll tell you that we got a lot of calls, and it was frankly very uncomfortable for me to have our staff telling the citizen, I'm sorry, we can't help you with that. You need to call Washington, D.C., where there are, I think our complaints are in the 3,000, 4,000 range. Theirs were like in the 20,000 for the whole country, which says that not a lot of people are getting through. And the measurements in the survey that we just completed, measurements in the Department of Justice, is that those complaints are the largest area of complaints for Oregonians consistently for the last 3 years. And it makes sense. You know, there are more opportunities and more opportunities for misunderstanding. So we're working through that. Our regulatory operations program, this is essentially the area where we're dealing with. They take in the filings and keep us in procedure and in legal, manage those processes for the schedules, make sure the public has the opportunity to know what's going on and work it out for the people. Very complicated legal processes to get through. One of the things that we're very proud of is our movements into what we call e-filing, electronic filing. We're moving more, as many of the courts are, into allowing electronic filing. Saves us money in terms of less handling of paper. It saves the parties money in terms of less paper to deal with, and it eases access to the information by the parties. In a typical rate case, well, I'll give you the example of the last case with Portland General Electric. We had almost 50 formal parties in the case, and each time someone asked for a piece of information, every one of those parties had to be served on it. By going through the electronic process, they get the information quicker, and it costs less to do it, and it's more accessible not only to them but to the citizens in general. So I think that's an important step, and it's in keeping with legislative direction to try to do things quicker, cheaper, better. our business services are...
Can we go back to the last slide?
Sure.
Citizens can participate directly in commission proceedings through your website. Can you share with us how that works?
I'll give you the example that is more illustrative. In the, as I was just talking about, the Portland General case, we put a specific, easy-to-use kind of email response, probably like you use in your newsletters and say, you want to send me a message, click here. We put the case information in a layman's terms on our website and said, if you want to share your perspectives with us and your thoughts, kind of click here, and it put it right into the file so that we got that. We got almost 1,000 citizen responses in that rate case. We've never got anywhere close to that in the past.
And what was the message?
I think that most of the message was, we don't like the deal.
Interesting. Thank you.
To be frank, the information we get through that source is not the most helpful in making the technical decisions that we have to make, which are, you know, as I like to say, we make the decision not on the politics, but on the numbers. But people have a right to feel heard and to be heard. And I will tell you that I read every one of those emails as they came in, and we responded. We acknowledged them so that citizens knew that they were heard. They may not have got a lengthy expense, but they got heard.
Let me ask a symbolic question. If I have my folks in Troy, Oregon, get online and try and download information off your website, is it going to be set up in a manner that they can do it quickly and efficiently?
God, I hope so.
Mr. Chair, we have tried to do that. If you're hearing something else, we would like to know, but we have tried to make it easy for them.
Please, that depends on the level of technical literacy of your parents.
You're talking about my family.
Technical literacy.
The question I have is if they try and download the information, should be able to do it just like any other citizen in Portland?
They should be able to.
Okay.
That's correct.
We'll find out.
We've tried to send it up that way, yes.
It is, I will tell you, Mr. Chair, that we were moving fairly clearly along one track, and from an electronic perspective, we really have two audience groups. Our biggest consumers are the lawyers and the technical people who sort of play in the judicial-like arena. But we also have the general citizens that are out there, too, so we're trying to have a website that responds to both of them. We figured out that the attorneys know how to get to what we call our e-docket system. That's what they're after. That would be a little harder to navigate for the ordinary citizen and probably wouldn't care to.
Let me take it to a simpler level. I'm glancing over and I see Representative Avakian has a very nice newsletter. Can you hold that up just really quick?
Not that I wasn't paying careful attention to everything you were saying.
PUC issues?
Yeah.
I have a newsletter very similar to that. We ended up having to modify our newsletter because the folks in Troy, Oregon, could not download that newsletter. Brand new computer. Well, raise that issue, we'll find out tomorrow.
I think, Mr. Chair, that the information is probably downloadable because it's not as pretty as that newsletter. But the web page looks a little nicer.
Let's just make sure that as we expand our website and citizens can participate, that it's all citizens.
Yeah. Frankly, the other challenge is that we've had to adapt our web page into the common format of DAS to make it work for everybody to port all. So it's a challenge to do that, but our goal is to try and get more information out there, particularly consumer services, to answer the question you asked earlier. Is we want people to be able to go in and say, how can I get help? And we try to put more there. The challenge is how do you get it there so they can, you know, without having to go down 20 layers. You know, it's really the decision tree question. Have we got it perfect? We're not even close, but we're working on it.
You're unfortunately getting the questions of a committee with 2 days to go through your budget.
All right, moving on. Business services, we were sort of there. Those are the standard, nothing unusual there. We're moving into our 10% reductions. Okay. The first one we looked at in the trying to get to that was continuing to reduce materials and services and supplies. And I should say that we really were trying to use three criteria as we were trying to evaluate how do you get 10% more out of the budget. One is not cutting anything that's absolutely critical to delivery of our mission. Second one was to try to gain efficiencies or deal with span of control. And last is to make sure that we didn't do a cut where maybe it was a short term, but we would lose the history, if you will, or the experience, the knowledge base. So this is what we came up with in any event. The first one is just to make almost a $361,000 reduction in services and supplies, and essentially this gets into the training, it gets into attorney fees and travelers and subscriptions. The potential risk to the department is that if it's long term, you're cutting down the ability to keep current, frankly. You're limiting, by cutting back on our AG retainer, we can try to do that, but it kind of depends on who decides to take us into court, quite frankly, and what process.
4 years ago, this committee had an issue regarding out of country transportation. Can you share with us how many out of country trips you've taken in the last biennium?
Mr. Chair, I'm proud to respond that we have substantially reduced our out of country travel to zero.
Thank you.
and none planned.
Thank you.
In fact, we have significantly reduced our travel in general. But I want to be clear. We can't. I don't believe it is wise for us to, you know, cut that completely or substantially, or reduces our ability to have an impact on particularly the FCC and the Federal Regulatory Commission's proceedings. If we're not participating, Oregonians don't have a voice in those proceedings.
Well, and I think that's an issue we talked about a little while ago, the importance of finding that balance,
yeah.
of making sure the state of Oregon is represented as a leader, but at the same time making sure that it's not so excessive that citizens in Oregon start to question whether we're leading the nation, the world, or the state of Oregon.
Mr. Willis has told me that he's much more comfortable talking with budget officers now than he was a few years ago with the current commission, so I'll leave it at that. Second area then was reducing a part-time worker in our utility program. Moving on down, we have a staff position. Our third choice would be to reduce the staff position in the utility section. After that, reduction in the state's contribution to the Residential Protection Fund, OTAP. Contract cut for $118,000 on top of that. Again, a staff reduction in a half-time administrative position. The next one is a yet another, the next two are reductions in staffing positions in that section. Reduction in our information systems. And then a reduction of one, the last one is a reduction in the gas facility, the safety room, which brings us down to the total 10% reduction of $3,470,000, almost $75,000. So that's how we get to the 10% reductions. I wouldn't advocate them, but they're there.
Is there any questions from the committee? On we
okay.
proceed.
Can you flip back just
to...
Well, my...
Up our
that's back. Not quite 10%, is it, Lee?
Did we miss?
You want to get your wallet out and find your $3?
We were.
I within think you're shortness, Mr. Chair.
We're within several dollars, but
Mr. Chair, care to pick up on the $3.
Senator Westland, you're correct, and I think Chairman Beyer planned on writing the check.
I'd love to see him taking some money sitting up here on the dais. Yeah.
Well, devil's in the details. It's a co-chair for you,
Mr. Chair. Senator Westland, I apologize for that oversight.
This is an egregious error.
All right. Next, we'll move into the program prioritizations, and we had six criteria on which we set our prioritization. One was the relationship to the mission, statutory requirements, number of customers affected, the level of the impact on Oregonians, perceived value by citizens, and return on investment. Moving into those then, and I'm just going to go through them in numeric order here. Our first priority is in our policy and administration office, and it's the commissioners, which you wouldn't expect anything less. Without the commissioners, you don't have a commission. Second is the utilities electric deregulation, and that's the effect there is the essential nature of the service and the customers affected, and it's within our primary mission. Our third priority is our administrative hearings division, as it applies to their work with related to the electricity regulation program. The fourth within our research and financial analysis section, again, ranked on the basis of its relationship to doing the electrical regulation. Without that, again, we have a hard time doing it. Fifth is in the telecommunications area, and again, we view that as being less of an essential service than the energy side, but it still affects the number of customers. Our sixth program priority was the administrative hearing section's work related to telecommunications, and similarly, seventh then is the research sides to the telecommunications regulation. Our eighth relates to the natural gas regulation, and again, it's the based on the number of services, or the essential nature of the services, and the number of consumers affected.
you may see a pattern here. It's usually the regulation, and the next two after that is the work of the hearings or the research section as it relates to delivering that service, because they're integrally tied together. 11th is pipeline safety, and while this is pipeline safety is very important, it's a federally mandated function, or it's a federal service that if Oregon didn't provide it, the feds would to some degree provide that, although to be honest, I don't think that you would see the same level of services, and it may or may not be good over time.
Lee, you know, every once in a while you hear about one of these just incredibly tragic accidents, some form or another of a volatile fuel pipeline rupturing, catching fire. Is there, do they have a, like a, you know, standard industry classification, safety classification for pipelines? And if there is any type of standardized matrix that that data goes into, where does Oregon stand on that? I mean, you know, is our pipeline infrastructure in good shape, mediocre shape, horrible shape? All of them are in great, except this one over here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, there is national standards. In fact, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. It's just been upgraded because of some of the explosions that you've heard about. I think the ones closest to home are up in Bellevue. Our system is, to a large degree, the pipeline system is 50 to 60 years old and has some of the same concerns that the interstate system has. It's just old infrastructure. It is, we just went through, they Office of Pipeline Safety, feds were focused on Washington State demanding. We stepped in and said, guys, that's the same pipeline that runs down through Oregon. We had them look at Oregon's too. We've been, frankly, we've been kind of pains. We wanted to check out. The system is in pretty good shape. On that, you were talking about the long lines. The distribution system has some of the same kinds of issues. In fact, we're going through a pipeline replacement system with Northwest Natural, but I don't think it's dangerous, but it's one that I'll tell you, last year when it was going there, I and the other two commissioners said to our staff, you get a hold of the feds and make sure that we're in as good a shape as Washington. I don't want them, because they degraded the pipes, are derated the pipes, couldn't put as much gas through them. So we have those issues, and it's important to do that.
Can you define pipeline?
A pipeline, the ones we're talking about are the natural gas pipelines. They're not the gasoline pipelines.
Right, what size?
Oh, I want to say that the big pipe is 24 inch. It starts, the natural gas pipes start for Oregon. There are two of them that come in from the north, from Canada. One comes across about Portland, and another one comes through your neck of the woods, Mr. Chair, over in the Hermiston area, and they run down the area, and they start out at the farther up yard, I think it's 24 inch, or maybe a little bigger than that.
My understanding
and they tailor down as they get. Our pipeline runs down in the Willamette Valley, runs down to, well, runs, goes all the way down to Medford, and then ties in with the line coming out of Canada.
My understanding is that the pipeline companies do an inspection on those weekly. Are they reporting that information to you folks?
They do report the information. I'm not sure they do. I'm not sure they do it weekly.
That's what they shared with me.
They said they do it weekly. It depends on how you define their inspection. But
it's literally in an airplane, and they literally drive the pipeline from the from Washington down to the California border in a little single plane. And let me tell you, committee, if you ever want an experience, go do that, because they have to maintain a certain elevation so they can see. And it's,
Mr. Chair, I'm sure that your colleague and good friend, Mr. Richardson, will explain to you that the good inspections are done by helicopter.
I see.
Oh, boy, you're getting me into trouble.
I'm just curious if they report that information to you.
Well, it's they do that, and they do every periodically, and I don't remember how often it is. I mean, you're getting a lot more detail than I know about. They what they call a pig. They run through the system, which is a large, looks like a log. It's a large electronic thing that they put in, and they push it through the pipeline, and it literally can test the welds and test the strength of the pipe, and it tests the electrolysis that's going on. The problem is if you
scratch the surface and get to the metal, the nature of the electrolysis will weaken and deteriorate the pipe. And that's what you don't want to have happen. But we spent, our staff spent a lot of time, for example, on the Coos Bay line that was completed this last year. We actually had the, every single weld was x-rayed.
Oh, yeah.
And we had the x-rays of every single weld that's there and physically inspected it. And it's the kind of thing that, frankly, you don't want to make a mistake on. When we do the job right, nobody knows, nobody cares. They only care when somebody cares, you hear about it and we hear about it.
Well, one of the many jobs I had through college was working on the MIST pipeline for Northwest Natural Gas.
Oh.
That's what I'm very familiar with.
They just completed the extension of that last year.
Right. So, anyway, let's continue forward.
Where was I? We were saying pipeline safety is our 11th priority. Our 12th is the medical certificates program. 13th is our consumer protection services. 14 is the telephone relay service. And again, the reduced priority there is the number of people that are served. 15 is the universal service fund. 16, the telephone assistance devices. 17, the hearings program related to operating that one, hearings activities related to that. Then the TDAP program, more telephone. 20th priority is the water program regulation of that. And again, following behind that, the administrative hearings as it relates to that and the support functions. And then 22 through 27 are just the business administrative activities. I don't want to go into details. 28th, and our final priority, is we provide under contract hearing services for the maritime pilots. They pay us for doing that. They requested us to do that. They have rate cases, and we do that.
Why you folks and not the employment department or the Central Hearings Panel, excuse me, that's operated through the Employment Department?
It had been done in the past by the Central Hearings Panel. The request came to us because they found that the level of training at the Central Hearings Panel and the experience in rate setting, which is a fairly complicated process, there wasn't the experiential factor there to do it. There aren't a lot of them, and frankly, our guys are trained to do it, and so they ask us if we would do it, and we do it on a reimbursable basis.
Okay.
And that's that on the program priorities. Again, our primary budget drivers are payroll expenses, rent, the Attorney General's fees, and we have two policy option packages out there. The gas one we'll talk about in a minute, and capital outlays related to that. The environmental factors that are affecting us is the growth of Oregon's population, a demand for financial assistance with telephone fees and services are continuing to drive. We've talked about that. State laws are changing rather quickly and changing the rules that we have to operate under and the rules that services are provided. The volatility in the electricity and natural gas markets has changed tremendously. I was talking with Peggy Fowler this morning about her business, and she was saying how different the business of operating electrical utility is now, not just sale of the company, but than it was 10 years ago. And apparently I came into this business at the wrong time, because everybody tells me that, it used to be a lot different. The drivers on electricity are natural gas and the fact that we're moved away from low-cost hydro, and every additional unit that we bring online costs more and have little, as the chairman said, have little control over natural gas prices as we watch petroleum prices go over $50 a barrel from where they were at 20, 25, 24. Technology changes in the telecom industry is a big change, and the changes on the national level related to that. A bit of history in terms of changes to the public utility issue. 95 session was a major change. The legislature took the motor carrier section out of the PUC and moved it to DMV. That followed deregulation of the trucking industry, and it made more sense to move it over there. 1996 was a watershed year in terms of Congress passed the Telecommunication Act, which set the competitive system in place for telecom, and we've been trying to catch up since then. 99-91, excuse me. Help me on that one, Rick. That was the AG fee increase.
Yeah, that was an increase in our AG fees to deal with the mini dis interconnection agreements that we had to process, and particularly the electric restructuring, because that was fairly new at the time.
Share with the committee really quick. What's the standard AG rate right now for your commission? The hourly rate.
What's the hourly rate for the
hourly rate? Hourly rate, we just went up.
Like 90.
Do you recall what they...
$98. Gone over 100.
And I think they were asking for like a $20 per hour increase.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, the current rate is 98 for the current biennium. I believe the proposed rate is 118, but that is under negotiation.
Yeah.
It's under negotiation. Negotiate hard.
Sure they will.
Can you share with us for tomorrow just the number of billable hours you folks have with the Attorney General's office?
We have, Mr. Chair, we have a retainer agreement with them. I'm just trying to think. We can ask them for how many hours they spend, but it's not billable hours. We have a retainer agreement with them.
How does it, can you share with us how that works?
I can actually bring you one of the contracts, yes, but they give us X amount of service for X amount of time, and if it goes over a little bit, they eat it. If it goes under a little bit, we eat it, and we've looked at it several times, and it's very close. And that way, they're not marking down every time we call up and they hit the clock and it counts 30 seconds. And it's a much more efficient system. As a matter of fact, there's several other agencies have looked at going to that.
I'd really be interested in looking at that.
Okay.
Simply to see how that would play out with other agencies we work with.
Yeah, it's worked very, very well for us. And I'd be happy to get you some information on that.
The advantage, from my perspective, of being able to have the retainer is that we, our process is such as we're always calling to, because everything we do is a court-like process, and asking for the legal advice of our attorney in charge. It allows us to have that section. I think we're probably like 90% of the business for the utilities and business regulatory section of the Attorney General's office. And we have in Paul Graham, our attorney in charge, we have a gentleman who's got about 31 years of experience in the business. So he's probably the most knowledgeable person there. There's virtually nothing we do that we don't have an attorney sitting with us on that. And in a rate case, not only do we have the attorney representing us, but by our process, once we assign an advocacy team of our staff, they're firewalled off. They operate separately, and they have an AG assigned to them to represent the agency and the proceedings in front of us, because it's a judicial procedure per se. So attorney's fees are a big deal to us. So negotiate really hard.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How essential is it that the AG do all your work? I mean, from a protecting the public interest.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I think it's absolutely essential. The nature of it is the...
Huh? That they do all of your work, that you wouldn't have the ability
they,
to...
They do all of our legal work. The procedural work, the arbitrations of that are handled by our law judges, but the representation of the commission and from the staff, the advocacy side in a rate case, we follow the civil rules of procedure that the courts have set up. We build the evidentiary record. We, in those cases, we perform the function of a trial court. Our decisions are appealable based on that record. There's not a new trial when you hit the courts on that. So it's Yeah, I'm not an attorney, but it has to be done right.
Jim. Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Weyers, just to kind of follow up on Senator Morris, the question is not whether you need good representation. The question is, are you receiving good representation at an efficient, effective, costly manner? And so would it be, would you be able to obtain the good representation you need from a private law firm at a substantially less price than what you're getting without DOJ?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I don't, under the rules that you have, and I believe the Constitution, I don't have the choice to go outside. I believe I have to, as this agency, I have to use the Attorney General. And in terms of price, that at $99 an hour or $119 an hour, that's a whole lot cheaper than the $300 an hour attorneys that the utilities are using.
Okay, but see, a minute ago you said you're on a contingency basis, I mean a
retainer
basis, so that you don't have to keep track of every phone call and every and all that. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're not keeping track of those things, then you really don't know what your full hourly utilization would be, because you're on a retainer. You're saying you think it's about the same, but unless you're tracking it, you really wouldn't know whether it is or not.
Actually, I actually think the attorney in charge does track that. Maybe not as religiously as he might if he were billing it out, but I think they do check. I think they do, and use that as a negotiation with, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, maybe I said it wrong. They do track the hours, but what they're not doing is hitting the button every minute, every call we make. But they estimate how many hours we use every month. And we get a monthly report that says how many hours. We're just not billably charged every time, every month for those. So we don't have to track, and we don't have to sit down every month and look at this 30 seconds. Does that compare to their 30 seconds? The retainer covers all of that.
Okay.
So they are watching. Like I said, they are very close. And if we see they start getting out of whack, we change the agreement. We have the agreement every 6 months. Well, we keep it very close. Both for their protection and for ours. But it's a far more efficient
system. One final comment is that we came across this, and we're having to deal with this in the PERS committee. Mm-hmm. The PERS board is in the same basic situation. And periodically, it doesn't hurt to look at monopolies inside the government as well as those outside the government, because, you know, we just need to make sure that things are effective and efficient and a good use of money, and not merely the fact that since you have to do it, like if you're talking about a $20 an hour increase, if you're a private corporation, you'd like to know why.
Yeah.
And you'd also want to be able to possibly bid that. You know, you don't just accept a 20% increase in your attorney's fees because the attorney says that that's what they want. And so it's not merely enough to say negotiate hard. If there's information that you have to provide in that, you know, we want to make sure it's balanced for them and balanced for each of the agencies as well.
Mr. Chair, and just to comment back to Senator Morris' original point is, I would tell you that as one of the three commissioners, I want to be able to, when I'm doing a TPG deal and trying to figure out what we can and can't do, to be able to pick up the phone and call Paul Graham and say, what does this mean and how much leeway do we have here? And I'll tell you that we spent a lot of time working through it on that deal, and we do in every deal with that. It's really key in making sure that. And frankly, one of the services they provide when we're done is they're the guys who have to stand in front of the appellate court when the utility or a consumer group challenges our order and defend it. And it's important that they make sure that that order is sustainable. Not only that we made the right decision, that's our job, but to make sure that it's defendable is their job.
Any other questions? Well, we're close to 3 o'clock. This seems like a good spot for us to pause until tomorrow.
Okay.
For tomorrow, I'd like to spend a little more time working on the performance measures. If you could just take a... How do you want to proceed on that committee, actually? Do you want us to work through those performance measures here? Do we want to ask them to go and work on them during the interim and come back to the audit committee? What do we want to do? The co-chairs have expressed a point of view that these need to be reframed so they're of more use to the Utility Commission and more useful for us. Senator Westland.
Well, if I could suggest, Mr. Chair, that probably the best format would be to work through the Audit Committee, obviously relying on the members on that committee, but also Dallas Wyan from LFO to develop a format that's meaningful to the legislature as well as helpful to the commission as well. I mean, that would be...
Why don't we take that suggestion then, and tomorrow we'll spend a little bit of time letting you know what's important to us.
That would be very
in
helpful.
In terms of monitoring and tracking, and then throw the ball to you and ask you folks to be working on that and to report back to the Audits Committee. Is that fair?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
That'd be very helpful to us, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And then also tomorrow, I think because of the amount of time we're going to have to be together tomorrow, I'd like to take a little bit of time and go through the trust and maybe get an overview of how that works and walk through that the process with this committee at a 101 type level and then let us, if we may, ask questions based upon the presentation. So, unless there's...
Chair, could I just...
Senator Westland.
Make a comment. The, in spite of the fact that I am incredibly crushed that your other two cohorts in crime are not here today, I just want to say, and this is much credit to many people, but I truly believe that the commission today is as strong as it has been in recent memory, and that you are serving this state as well as anyone has in this capacity. And regardless of controversial recent decisions, I mean, your job is to make the correct decision, not the desired decision. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator.
It wasn't long ago that Senator Westland was Representative Westland in having to deal with this commission as they were working through some of the controversial issues that they had. And I do think it's a credit to you and your staff. So,
thank you.
Representative Richardson.
I'd like to just carry over till tomorrow a discussion on, out of your 125 employees, why it's justified to have 26 managers with a supervisory ratio of less than 1-4. And why that would be necessary and appropriate, and if not, what could be done over the next biennium to reorganize that. You can discuss that tomorrow. And also, I've gone also over the performance measures, and every one of them appear to be internally valuable but not valuable to the committee because they don't focus on the outcomes that we can measure other than those that are proposed for administration. So, we'd love to not have you have so many that you have to come to us with. They don't do this.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, we're very welcoming of any recommendations, and we'll be prepared to talk about the staffing.
Well, today we've gone through a great overview. We've gone through the performance measures. We've gone through the 10% reduction list. Tomorrow, committee, bring your calculators and be prepared to delve into the budget and work through that and a possible work session as well. So, with that said, unless there's... we'll be adjourned.